What will it take to finance an energy transition that leaves no one behind? I asked this question to Wuchang Um, CEO of the Global Energy Alliance for People and Planet, to understand the challenges hindering existing capital reaching the communities that need it most. Drawing on decades of experience in international development finance, Wuchang explains why the challenge isn't simply a lack of money, but a lack of bankable projects, supportive policy, and investor confidence. He provides real-world examples from grid-scale battery storage in India and Malawi to innovative community energy projects in Indonesia, demonstrating the power of partnerships in unlocking investment while creating lasting economic opportunity. It's an optimistic take on de-risking investment, building stronger energy systems, and demonstrates why a successful energy transition depends on putting people and planet at the heart of economic prosperity. I'm Pamela Logg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Wuchang, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about what is a really important topic, increasingly so, and that is financing the energy transition. But I think before we get into talking about the specifics, tell us a little bit more about the Global Energy Alliance for People and Planet and your mission as CEO.
Yes, yeah, thank you very much. It's so nice to be here with you. It's a wonderful opportunity. The Global Energy Alliance was set up about 5 years ago. We're approaching 5 years, fifth year birthday in November. We were launched in Glasgow in 2021 as we were just starting to revive the convenings, I guess, in the tail end of the COVID-19. So other than establishing this organization, you know, the significance of sort of coming out of COVID was, it's in a vivid memory. Now, this was organized because the development world is progressing quite well, but still there's something missing in terms of reaching the last mile of energy transition. And as you know, the energy is a foundation for all of the economic development. There are examples in different parts of the world. In my home country in South Korea, energy was a foundation when the economic development started in the 50s and 60s. And without it, today we will not have, Samsung, Hyundai, or even BTS, right? For that matter, to make that progress. So energy is a foundation for economic development, and things have been quite well under, within the existing development partners. But the issue is that why the number of people do not have electricity stayed at 700 million people for the last 10 years. 20 years prior to that, progress has been quite phenomenal. And I think largely due to the excellent work done by my former organization, the Asian Development Bank and World Bank and others, who are massively deploying capital resources to electrify people. But still, when you got to 700 million people, we got stuck. So this organization was set up with the initial support from the three key philanthropic organizations, Rockefeller Foundation, IKEA Foundation, and Bezos Earth Fund, to do exactly that, figure out why is it not happening beyond, the threshold of the, reduction of number of people without electricity to below 700 million people. What we do is we look to see who are the development partners that are active, what's going well, and then we actually let people do what they do. But if they're unable to do something, for example, channeling finance to the areas where there's no electricity and somehow it's not getting there, figure out what's the problem and try to bring in the unlikely partners across the public and private and now philanthropic partners to be able to tackle this problem together. So that's the gist of what we try to do. And yeah, I don't know whether you know my background. I came from the Asian Development Bank, working there for 31 years. And prior to that, I was with the private sector in the U.S., Pfizer. Well, everybody knows Pfizer now because of COVID. And then I decided to move on from the ADB, partly to see what else can I do to make a difference in this world, and especially in the energy transition.
That is why it was so important for me to actually talk to you about financing the transition, because your experience really lends itself to helping us understand where the challenges lie and how do you actually unlock financing. And that's a great segue into my next question, because I want to know, Do you believe that financing is actually the biggest bottleneck in terms of driving the energy transition forward? Or is it a case of technology or infrastructure or political will? What are your thoughts?
I would say that the finance or financing or lack thereof, in some places, it's actually a symptom of a bigger problem of various parts perhaps not working well enough together to move energy transition forward. So if you're talking about developed country with low risk, you know, there's money out there, right? So that's going to be flowing. But obviously those places are, you know, more saturated with financial resources. But the development world is where the opportunities are, right? So that's where, you know, 700 million people need to be electrified. So you need money to flow. So why isn't money flowing? You know, is it a technology or is it something else? And it's interesting going back several years when I look at, you know, discuss with the, you know, think tanks and engineers or whoever, developers, they talk about the development needs around the world in energy space is in trillions of dollars, right? And there's so many projects out there that needs financing. But then when you talk to the bankers or investors, they say there are no projects. So what's happening, right? So there are projects out there, but there are no projects. So that basically means that there are not enough bankable projects that money can flow to. And, you know, that happens for multiple reasons. One is a lot of the projects that people talk about are in blueprint concept stage. And then you have an idea of what kind of project needs to be. You know, these people need to be electrified. So obviously, there's got to be some project that's going to invest into those projects. But these are blueprint projects that requires further development. So you need to do due diligence, you need to do feasibility study, you need the wind mapping if you're looking at, you know, possible wind solutions. So not enough of project development is happening to move project from concept to bankability, right? Now, even if you move some of those projects to a bit, you know, more bankable state, in some cases, those projects might be in locations in the economies where there's not enough certainty in terms of policy framework, right? So if somebody wants to put money into a country or region, they want more or less certainty that there's a regulatory system that will allow them to, that money to work in the right way. So a lot of the capacity building needs to happen. The capacity building could mean establishing regulations, but also it could mean training people to understand it. Even if you have the regulatory framework, people who are, you know, capable of managing the process, projects which have concepts developed into bankability, still there could be a risk that people might not want to take. So, you know, if you talk about like pension funds and all these, you know, investors, you know, it's a hard-earned money, right? So you don't want money just going anywhere and then not having to see it again. So it's, people have risks in their mind, and there are two types of risks. One is real risk, which can be mitigated by deploying instruments, you know, insurance or, you know, first loss cover, blended financing, catalytic financing that enables investors to buy down the cost of the risk. So these are some of the real risks that can be mitigated, which will help. But there's another big risk that people have harder time dealing with, which is a perceived risk. You know, so this is quite interesting because perceived risks, there's actually nothing you can do in terms of deploying, you know, instruments to buy down. The only way to do it is to demonstrate. So when I talk about this, I often use the analogy of gazelles crossing a river. And you know, as I'm getting older, I become more like my father, late father who passed away last year at 97. You know, I watch Animal Kingdom in the morning on Saturdays. And I don't know why, but I keep watching all these animals chasing each other. And there's one video clip which really stuck in my head, which was there was a river and there are like hundreds of gazelles on one side. Lions, hungry lions are approaching from the van side. Approaching the gazelles. So these gazelles knew the danger on that side. So they wanted to cross the river. But then the river was full of crocodiles or alligators with whatever it is there. So you could literally see like hundreds of gazelles kind of hesitating, not knowing what to do, until one brave gazelle jumped in. And then he or she jumped in and then stumbled over to different, you know, over even stepping on some of the crocodiles and miraculously survived and crossed over. Then the entire group of gazelles jumped in, and vast majority of gazelles made it through. So I was looking at it, it was like, wow, that's like climate change in a way, right? So danger is coming, you need to do certain things, invest in clean energy, but there's a perceived risk of danger by doing that. The risk of certain death in that case as a community is actually grasped, you know, really, really reduced when the communities work together, right? The partners. So, you know, if the gazelles were to jump in one by one, obviously they probably would have been, you know, became, you know, have become a dinner for the crocodiles, but having them working together saved that community. So I was thinking, hey, this is the role of the philanthropies. We should be that gazelle, that first one that jumped in to establish or demonstrate that perhaps the danger is not as, the risk is not as great as people perceive. And, you know, that's through demonstration pilots, but stacking, doing it in a way that they're financing, large amount of financing is available to invest into those demonstrated projects that we can work with. You know, that is the beauty of philanthropic capital, because, you know, we don't have the kind of constraint that the multilateral development bank, you know, banks have, which is, you know, they're all AAA organizations and their business model is to use their AAA to mobilize vast amount of resources to deploy. Now, their biggest asset, which is the AAA, in some cases, when we talk about the 700 million people who do not have electricity, is their biggest handicap, because if they're AAA, then the investment have to be AAA. Without that, it won't flow. So we can help them maintain that AAA status by demonstrating viable projects so that it does bring down the risk enough to be able for them to be invest. Often I love analogies, and I want to make sure that the philanthropic capital and organizations can work like a tugboat for barge with lots of money to be able to navigate the difficult terrains and actually go to put their money, go to places where they could not go without us, right? So that's the kind of things that we do to make sure that the finance, again, as I said, it's a symptom of the bigger problem of the system that doesn't allow financing to flow to some of the developing country context where the money is needed.
First of all, I feel like we need to have a separate podcast dedicated to the interaction between lions and gazelles. It was really marvelous to picture that. So thank you, Ru Chung, for breaking it down for us like that. And I, you know, how interesting to think that, yes, we need that philanthropic capital. We need somebody to take the first leap. But I think, you know, when it comes to perceived risk, and I speak from someone who is living in what some people might consider more of a developing nation than others, but there's risks around policy frameworks or the lack thereof, and risks around good governance and transparency. And, you know, I think my question to you is, how do we really overcome these risks, and how do we get the gazelles to jump, Ru Chung? I know this is a big question, but I'm keen to get your thoughts.
No, I mean, this is not a new problem, right? So multilateral banks have been trying to work on these things, right? So identifying the, what are the, you know, bottlenecks within the regulatory framework that they need to overcome. So they've been allocating a lot of resources to support developing countries to develop these regulations and train them, increase their capacity to be able to manage. But you still need somebody to help navigate through. So for example, in the case of India, where we deploy the first in that South Asia region, utility scale battery storage to be integrated into the system. Actually, before I talk about that, I should probably talk about the technological problem they were trying to solve. So in terms of really moving the renewable energy, the energy transition, renewable energy has to be a key role, right? But from our standpoint, generation of a new generation of renewable energy sources is not the problem. There's enough renewable energies being generated, but the grids are not optimal enough to be able to manage, you know, to be able to digest that. So in the case of India, they say over 50% of their new energy generation, power generation, is from renewable energy source, but the actual use is 23-24%. That means you're actually having a big heart, but veins not big enough to be able to put blood through. So we are working on optimizing the grid. So incorporating battery storage so that you can make use of the off-peak time or make use of the availability of the sun to be stored and then use it when the sun, when the electricity is needed in the evening and so forth. And we're also looking at using the AI to optimize the operation of the grid by the utilities, so that increased by 30-40%, which means there's more abundant electricity and then also no need for new generation. So reduction of greenhouse gas. So to tackle the battery problem, so we had this project in Delhi. It's a very crowded area. They need more electricity, but there's no land to expand their generation. So we worked with the developers to integrate battery storage, about 40 megawatts worth of electricity, right? And the technologically is not a very complicated thing. In this, and then India has had the regulations, but no one's ever done it before, right? So the first time doing this, the biggest asset that we created was a playbook of how to navigate through the internal systems in the country to be able to get the sign off, how to get the tariff regime to be approved, and various government approvals that's required to get this thing done. So once that whole process only took less than 1 year to the finish, and once we switched on the project, the biggest value was other people using the playbook to follow the same thing. So after we completed, I understand the city of Delhi, they issued a bid for proposals for deals that's worth 80 gigawatts of electricity battery storage. So the kind of demonstration that happens, regulation is there, the officials are trained, but there's actually a real life project that actually went through once, right? And then we have to make sure that knowledge coming out of this, that kind of experience, is disseminated, not just within the country, but to other parts of the world. So fast forward, we did the Delhi thing last year, and then this year, just last week, in Malawi, in the suburbs, just switched on, commissioned the Malawi battery energy storage system plant. And we actually got some of the officials from Malawi to learn from India experience so that they know exactly what happened, the opportunity, right? So this is where, people have to imagine what's possible, right? And imagination is a good thing, but seeing is believing. But when they see a possibility, then they can actually turn that into doing something that's impossible to do, right? So cross south-south, cross-pollination or cross-fertilization, whatever you call it, south-south learning is something that's also very helpful in making sure that the financing flows to some of the new places that needs electricity.
Ruchong, I feel like you've given us a recipe here, and I just want to highlight that it's really a case of imagination, partnership, and collaboration, and information sharing. Do you think that recipe will help developing nations to leapfrog to where they need to be in terms of electrification?
There was an article written by Hannah Ritchie a few weeks ago or a couple of months ago, and there was a kind of stark reality, and they said something about, will Africa still be energy poor by 2050? And that one I had to react, because I said, well, if you do the business as usual, that will remain. Because in the past, in many occasions, when people try to deploy electricity, they only thought about providing access to people. And then people would, in the rural areas, would just turn on two lights or turn up. Now they'll charge the phones, right? Not enough thought or action were taken to see what electricity can do to uplift their livelihood and increase their income. So we call that the powering opportunity. So we have two pillars that we are working under. One is the grid of the future to optimize the grid using battery storage and the AI. Now, the other side, so the grid of the future is providing more supply of electricity. But other side, what we are calling the powering opportunity is the demand side. So when we provide electricity, what can we do to help the farmers to really transform the way they live and the way they live economically? You know, when farmers are working under the normal business as a new business as a usual case, you know, their processing of agriculture crops is largely manual, or even if they have equipment, their electricity is not available consistently and when it's needed, right? So linking the two together, you're actually increasing the financial viability of the electrification effort, right? So, you know, we actually have a very interesting program that we are kind of cooking up in the remote island in India, in Indonesia, where the problem is fisher folks are poor because their fish catch is getting spoiled because there's no place to store. So initially, we were looking at providing cold storage. And then when you start talking about that, potential financiers come and even people wanted to deploy diesel generators to electrify that, you know, comes in. But of course, we provide the right kind of knowledge so that solar energy is provided for to use the cold storage. Now, that does two things. One is, of course, it's good for greenhouse gas reduction, but also it's actually cheaper and more stable. You don't have to rely on fossil fuel that comes from somewhere else. And, you know, geopolitics could actually impact that, right? So that's a great solution. So originally, the problem is that the fisher folks have the market, the radius of their market is like 10, 15 kilometers, right? Because they have to quickly go and sell them. And then they lose like 30, 40% of their fish catch. So we expand that market by like into like 100 kilometers. Now you have cold storage. Now that's not enough because that doesn't address the problem of whether or not there's enough fish in the ocean because of the climate, the global warming, sea warming, degradation of mangroves, and also overfishing. Now, if you actually provide only cold storage and give fisher folks incentive to catch more fish, it's going to, you know, exacerbate the overfishing issue. So we actually partnered with the Conservation International and Conservancy Indonesia to come together so that we talk about energy and then conservation on the coastal areas. And they have programs that they're planning to do restoration of mangroves, which will actually populate fish, you know, increase the fish availability, but also it generates blue carbon because of the mangrove restoration is a very powerful tool. So the blue carbon revenue would get pumped back into the community so that they can be trained to expand or diversify their fish products, or seafood products, right? So to move from just catching tuna fish to seaweed, for example, and then enable them to be able to process it so they can sell it to Japan and Korea. So often you go from having 10, 15 kilometer radius market to 100 to 2,000-3,000 kilometers away where they can actually increase the market. And when you do that, then it becomes a great business proposal for, you know, fisheries companies and, you know, the shipping companies to be able to take advantage of this thing, right? So we're calling this a sun to sea initiative, linking sun and the sea together and then bringing the energy and conservation work to benefit at the end the fisher folks. So this actually creates the demand for electricity. And without this program, you would have barely people turning on their lights, which makes it still very much not so financially viable. So those kind of interventions will have to rely on, you know, aid support. Whereas this sun-to-sea model, it can be an investment from private sector. And this is becoming very, very interesting for all of Indonesia, and then all of the regions and then other parts of the world. And, you know, we are working with multilateral development banks for them to be getting ready to program a rural development program, which can be in hundreds of millions of dollars. And if you can aggregate this kind of investment opportunity to go from, you're gonna first work on 20 pilots and 20 fishing villages to 100 to 1,000. Now, as we get to 100, 500, 1,000 villages and to other regions, you need a large amount of money, right? So if you can do that and partner with the multilateral development banks, then we can have a viable investment opportunity for the big banks to come in. And then they can also, you know, bring in private sector to leverage, right? So that's the idea of having supply side, grids of the future, and then the demand side, the powering opportunity, so that we enable electricity to be used productively by people on the ground.
What an incredible example of sustainable financing and financing with a view to the future, and actually also really empowering local people and developing nations and using what's at their disposal. Yes, their indigenous wisdom and knowledge to actually allow them to develop themselves in a way.
This kind of thing, and a similar kind of thing in Brazil, you know, we're working in the jungles, providing, you know, solar energy for them to be able to process their acai, their products, and at the same time protecting the nature, right? So, you know, we are actually turning the local people to go from being a consumer of the natural resources to become a guardian of the natural resources where they live in. And then at the same time, be more prosperous.
Exactly. And I find this so encouraging because all of the conversations that we seem to be having these days, they're centered around geopolitical uncertainty and turmoil. And, you know, people are saying, yes, we need a lot of investment for the energy transition. Where will the money come? And should we focus more on decarbonization or energy security? And it seems like we've lost the balance, or perhaps a more balanced approach. It seems to be such an either-or situation where people are firmly on either side of the aisle, which is unfortunate. And I just feel like this kind of model really gives us hope that we can still have bankable projects available that prove that, yes, you will still get a return on your investment, but we can still continue decarbonizing, continue with the energy transition and moving forward with that. Are you optimistic, Wuchang?
You know, our organization's name is Global Energy Alliance for People and Planet, right? So at the end of the day, you know, we want the people and the planet to work together and optimize whatever situation that we have. And, you know, in a way, you know, I'm very optimistic about the future because, you know, I never thought the energy transition, clean energy, climate, and economic development are not mutually exclusive. You know, they go hand in hand. And for energy transition to really thrive, it can't be just about climate. It's got to be anchored in the economic development, right? And the two can really coexist and feed off each other. So, you know, the current situation, in a way, it's a very positive thing because it kind of jolts people to do something new and different. And, you know, when you, it's a human nature to do something different than what they're used to, right? Business as usual, right? So, you know, people in some of the, you know, conferences that I've been to, you know, people worried about the current geopolitical situations, you know, when will it go back to normal, you know, and what can we get back to do what we do? And I was, you know, really vocal about it, says we don't want to go back to normal. There's a new normal and it's a better normal, which we can, everybody can benefit. So I think the current crisis can be leveraged, and I think we should not let it go to waste and really use this opportunity as a jolt, a launch pad to really accelerate the energy transition.
A launch pad to accelerate the energy transition. Those are very inspiring words. Wuchang, thank you so much for joining us today and just for sharing your wisdom and insight. And I think also just providing a very positive spin on what is a very tumultuous time for everyone. So thank you so much.
So thank you very much again for having us.
Until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast. brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Larg, and our producer, Rion Mostert. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.